Truth is, what matters in a government budget is more than just the bottom line, right? Budget assumptions is where we start today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday today, the 10th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the White House budget proposal, a $4.8 trillion plan announced this morning, the details of which are being covered in depth elsewhere, despite the reality that Congress is going to decide what any budget bill eventually actually says. But we were struck by something the president's acting budget director, Russell Vogt, said earlier today on another radio program.
Over the 10-year period, the economic agenda of this president will pay for the cost of the tax cut.
Okay, it was Morning Edition. That's an idea, though, that we have heard before a lot, and not just from the Trump administration, that tax cuts pay for themselves.
We've had decades of experimentation with this, and there's not been a case where tax cuts pay for themselves.
Kimberly Clausing teaches economics at Reed College. She speaks here of the Reagan tax cut in 1981, the George W. Bush tax cuts 20 years later as well.
I think they think that if they keep saying it, some fraction of people will believe it.
Mark Mazur is the director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
Generally, that's wishful thinking, and it goes back at least to the Reagan years. I can't think of any tax cut that has been passed by the U.S. Congress that one could say has paid for itself.
What happens, Mazur says, is that budget plans and tax cut bills are built with at least one really big contingency.
It's like tax cuts can pay for themselves if all the other policies that we want to pass get enacted into law.
A post-policy projection is what that's called. One other thing, Mr. Vogt, the president's acting budget director, said on that other radio program we all listen to as we go about our mornings, caught our ear, that the economy is going to grow, he said, at 3% this year and for the next couple of years. Again, Mark Mazur at Urban Brookings.
It's also a little bit disingenuous to try and predict a fairly robust growth path when we haven't seen it for the last few years.
Most recent data on this, by the way, from a couple of weeks back, gross domestic product growth slowed to an annual rate of 2.3% last year as the budget deficit passed $1 trillion. Again, what Congress decides to do about the budget matters a lot here. All right, moving on. You remember that big Equifax data breach a couple of years back? Hackers got hold of the names, birth dates, and Social Security numbers of 145 million of us. Federal prosecutors announced charges in that case today, charges against four members of the Chinese People's Liberation Army. This is the latest, if by far the largest, in a string of hacks that American officials have tied to Beijing. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more now on how China might use that trove of data it's got.
In a press conference, Attorney General William Barr described the Equifax breach as more evidence of China's voracious appetite for Americans' personal data,
including the theft of personnel records from the Office of Personnel Management, the intrusion into Marriott Hotels and Anthem Health Insurance Companies, and now the wholesale theft of credit and other information from Equifax.
Chinese officials have denied any connection to previous hacks, but cybersecurity experts say there are lots of reasons China might want that data. Priscilla Moriucci is a researcher with the security intelligence firm Recorded Future. She says sensitive financial information like debts could be used by Chinese spies to target potentially vulnerable Americans.
So building profiles of individuals that could be susceptible to recruitment by Chinese intelligence services.
Georgetown professor Ben Buchanan wrote a book about cybersecurity called The Hacker and the State. He says the data could also help China identify Americans operating undercover in Beijing.
But my guess is that the biggest determining factor here of why the Chinese did this is that they could. And why not take it and why not see what might be useful down the line?
Buchanan says it's exceptionally unlikely Chinese hackers will see the inside of an American courtroom, but the charges do send a message that the U.S. government is trying to track and deter foreign hacking. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Ticker symbol EFX today. Equifax down 0.6%. Otherwise, a slow, steady climb at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today. Details, numbers, you know the drill. China officially went back to work today after the coronavirus forced the government to extend the Lunar New Year holiday. The return to work picture is mixed, though, given the reality that 900 people have died and there are more than 40,000 people infected. Some companies, medical equipment suppliers most particularly, have worked through the break, but a lot of businesses have decided to extend the holiday further or maybe just have people work from home. Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has been working in Shanghai.
On Shanghai's traffic station, a public service announcement calls on China citizens to battle the new coronavirus. The PSA features President Xi Jinping. He says he's confident China can win what he calls the people's war against the virus. And businesses are joining in, like Dasheng, a company that makes face masks. At its factory in southwest Shanghai, dozens of machines cut and sew cotton pieces into disposable face masks. Every item manufactured here used to be sold overseas, most recently to Australia during the bushfires.
But we've asked our Australian clients to source from elsewhere because of this virus outbreak. We need to help China.
That's company chairman Wu Shengrong. He's showing off his factory as part of a government-organized press tour. Dasheng is one of at least a dozen factories mobilized by the Shanghai authorities to redirect their face masks to China. But it hasn't been easy. When the factory restarted production on January 21st, most of Dasheng's workers were in their hometowns for the Lunar New Year holiday.
I pulled in all remaining staff in Shanghai to operate the machines, including managers, security guards, and janitors.
Supervisor Wu Yi says she's been working 10 hours a day. By law, she should be compensated three times her daily salary for working the holidays and paid double for overtime. So, is she?
That's not something I'm even thinking about right now. We're just focused on rushing the orders out.
For companies that have nothing to do with containing the virus outbreak, many things are decided on the fly. For example, James Gao runs a shoe business consultancy in southern Guangdong province. Officials there initially said workers could return to the office this week. Then, just 72 hours beforehand, China's National State Council said employees should work from home instead. Which is fine by Gao. He says his team can work remotely, though some of his foreign clients did have to put off a planned visit.
We gave him advice. We said, try to postpone it as much as possible.
So much depends on whether the authorities can contain the virus in Wuhan, the epicenter of the outbreak. Officials have restricted transport into and out of the city, where investor Tian Changxing lives. He says it's harder to find basic stuff like meat and vegetables.
There isn't a lot left at supermarkets, and a number of them have closed.
Further north in Liaoning province, the virus has not spread widely, but schoolteacher Jane Ma says she's still not allowed to go back to work.
Because all schools and universities are shut for the safety of the children until further notice.
She says she stays home mostly, just to be safe. In Beijing, YY, a freelancer in marketing, says she always wears a mask when she's outdoors, even though the World Health Organization and the CDC say they won't protect the general public against the virus.
Almost every news report and WeChat message in China talks about wearing one. You're almost treated like a criminal if you don't wear a mask outside.
Back at the Dasheng factory, workers wrap each face mask in plastic. Once all its staff is back at work, the company hopes to double its output to 200,000 masks a day. That still won't meet the demand in a city of 24 million people. But company boss Wu Shengrong says every little helps.
I'm a Communist Party member. Government leaders should rest assured that my staff and I will do everything we can to help fight the virus.
As he speaks, reporters are ushered out, and the government tour ends. The staff need to get back to work, an official says. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
The best animated short Oscar last night went to a film called Hair Love. And with it came attention to some new anti-discrimination laws. It's a film about an African-American dad learning how to do his daughter's hair. And when writer and director Matthew Cherry took to the stage, he called for nationwide adoption of laws that prevent discrimination based on hairstyle and texture. Laws like that, they're known as Crown Acts, have passed in California, New York, and New Jersey. They've been proposed in more than 20 other states and in Congress as well. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
L.A. writer Liz Dwyer vividly remembers what her dad said when she decided to end decades of straightening her hair to wear her natural curls.
That if I did this, that I would never get a real job ever again.
That concern was legit, says Dwyer. Like many Black women in America, she's dealt with scrutiny of her hair at work.
You know, you come in with your hair super straight and your boss says, you know, this looks so much better, but it's letting you know that the standard is professionalism is that your hair be straight.
Only three states have passed Crown Acts, California, New York, and New Jersey. Angela Onwuachi-Willig, the dean of the Boston University School of Law, says some courts elsewhere argue that because hairstyle is changeable, it's not an issue of racial discrimination.
Courts have responded by saying you could change your hair without understanding that these hairstyles are precisely what allow African Americans to keep their hair in the same texture that it grows out of their heads.
She says policies that prohibit unprofessional hairstyles can target African Americans because many of their hairstyles are perceived negatively. A 2017 study by the Perception Institute, which studies implicit bias, found a majority of the 4,000 participants of all races and genders held some bias against women of color based on their hair. Here's lead author Alexis McGill-Johnson.
Even though our explicit values may have changed, our implicit attitudes were still well behind.
And those attitudes often get internalized. McGill-Johnson admits she still usually wears her own hair straight for work. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Museums are very particular organizational creatures.
Yeah, they're businesses, but only kinda. First, though, sure, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 174 today, 0.6%, 29,276. The NASDAQ up 107 points, 1.1%, 96.28. The S&P 500 advanced 24 points, 0.7%, 33.52 there. Some news on the merger front today. Edgewell Personal Care, the maker of Schick razors, said it's not going to buy rival Harry's after all. That's because the Federal Trade Commission said the $1.3 billion deal would shave down competition. Come on, how do you not love that? Edgewell brushed up 27.5% today. Gotta love that sandwich at Popeyes, the chicken sandwich that came and went and then came back, drove up Popeyes sales 34% last quarter. Parent company Restaurant Brands, other change though, Burger King and Tim Hortons not quite as hot, and thus Restaurant Brand shares served up only 2.7% following their earnings report. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, there is an economic reality to the electoral politics of this moment here as we are on the eve of New Hampshire with Nevada and South Carolina looming. The headline numbers on this economy look all right, as we have said many times on this program. But as we have also said a time or two, the headline numbers don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world unless people are feeling them in their everyday. Unemployment's at a 50-year low, 3.6%. We have added jobs every month for a decade now, but the next three states up in the primary rotation each have a different local dynamic. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has been digging in. Hey, Mitchell.
Hey, Kai. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. So let's talk about these three states that are coming up tomorrow and in the next couple of weeks. How are they doing once you start looking at things?
You know, overall, they're doing a lot like the rest of the country. They've got low unemployment, relatively low unemployment, pretty good job creation. New Hampshire's actually at 2.6% unemployment, South Carolina 2.3%. But, you know, there's an asterisk once you drill down. New Hampshire has had very weak job growth. They virtually had no job growth last year. So it's not a very dynamic, fast-growing economy. It's got a lot of older people, retired people. There just isn't a lot of dynamism there. South Carolina had decent job growth last year and its unemployment rate's low, But, you know, manufacturing is a bigger player there, mm-hmm. and it's in a slump, just like elsewhere in the country.
Yeah.
Nevada, in some ways, is sort of, you know, got the best of all worlds. It's got pretty low unemployment, like the national average, and it's had really strong job growth. And, you know, that has to do with casinos and hotels, tourism, construction is booming, e-commerce. It's sort of got all the pieces of it, and it's got a higher minimum wage than the national average. So a lot of those lower wage workers are actually doing better.
Yeah, and organized labor is really strong there. So let's imagine that you are Mitchell Hartman, high-profile campaign consultant, and you are advising in our fantasy world both Republicans and Democrats as they try to shape messages in these three states. What are you telling them?
Well, I mean, for President Trump, you know, just keep reading the State of the Union address. I mean, you know, job growth's strong, unemployment's low, you got money in your pocket, you know, that's the tax cuts. You know, in some of these states, Black and Hispanic voters are important, South Carolina and Nevada. Well, unemployment for those groups is at or near historic lows. So just, you know, keep it going.
Okay, so for the Democrats who want the president's job, what do you say?
Well, you say, oh, no, that's not true. You know, look at your wallet, look at your pocketbook, look at your paychecks. Yeah, maybe unemployment's low and job creation's pretty strong. But, you know, have you noticed that your wages haven't gone up a whole lot? Well, the rent is going up, the doctor bills, the prescription drugs are going up, the college tuition, you know, the student loans that the kids will never be able to pay. So they're going to be living with you for the rest of your life. Those are the kinds of things that you're going to try to point out, which is that, you know, those headline numbers that tell the story of the whole big national economy don't tell the individual stories of people's financial and economic anxieties in this economy.
Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman with a little bit of the politics of the American economy as we head deep into primary season. Mitchell, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Kai.
There's a market we don't get to very often on this program, a market where billions of dollars in goods are traded every year. The global art market is where we land for this next segment. For a lot of us, we mostly get exposure to that market in museums. And it so happens that a 10-minute walk from where I stand right now is a world-class museum. The Broad Museum houses the private collection, something like 2,000 pieces of contemporary art of billionaire philanthropists Eli and Edith Broad. Anyway, we showed up just before opening the other day and met up with Joanne Heiler.
Joanne, how are you?
Hi,
Rizdal. Nice to see you.
Nice to see
Thanks
you, too.
Welcome.
Welcome to the Broad.
Heiler is the founding director of the Broad, which this year celebrates its fifth anniversary.
You know, I was doing my reading for this, and it's amazing it's been 5 years. I mean, it's gone like that.
It has gone like that.
Right?
And the amount of people who've come to the museum is just astounding us.
Yeah.
And we didn't even expect it. We expected about 300,000 a year.
And it's how many now?
Last year, we welcomed 917,000 people.
That's amazing. I mean, if you drive by and you see the lines, it doesn't surprise you, but it's still kind of amazing.
It is amazing.
Also, this is not off topic. This is not an especially big museum. I mean, it's not huge, right?
I sometimes joke that we might be the most visited museum on a per square foot basis.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? I mean, huge collection, but it's not a giant place. You can get through it pretty easily.
Yeah, I think it feels good. People tell me that it feels different here. It feels welcoming here.
Yeah.
And then they tell their friends who are visiting from out of town, and here we are.
And that gets to the kind of people you have here. And I don't want to get too deep into demographics, but museum people tend to run old and mostly white, right?
Traditionally, yes. And we have seen a very different audience come into the Broad. So our audience is about 70% non-white. And our average age visitor is in their low to mid-30s, whereas it's more like mid-40s nationally.
Okay, so you're an art curator, right? You're a professionally trained art person. I imagine there's a little bit of marketing and branding that goes along with that, but how do you get that diverse clientele in here?
Well, we did a lot of things when we were planning this museum that changed how it feels to be in a museum for a visitor. We took away a lot of barriers, starting with free general admission.
Mm-hmm.
But we also took a note from digital retail and thought about the fact that can't we just do everything in a mobile device in terms of ticketing, et cetera.
The Rhodes Collection is also kind of a lending library for other contemporary art museums. The portion that's not on display, stored behind all kinds of locked doors.
I'm going to badge you
in here.
Yes,
thank you.
Inside, the art world turns decidedly unglamorous.
This is so funny. They're just kind of hanging there in little slots.
They hang in slots.
Which, of course, makes sense. But do you have a favorite that we can pull out and have a look at? Ooh. I actually, this is Basquiat, right?
This is Basquiat.
Yes, for me. Come on.
A painting called With Strings 2. And the great thing about the Basquiats in this collection that I think is it's not always the case, is that they were all purchased in the time that they were made.
How do you know when there's a piece that you want to acquire for this museum?
Well, that's a great question. And it is one of the great, great things about, I think, working in contemporary art, where you just have to live as a curator or a collector and be happy to live with a little bit of not knowing. You know, you can't possibly know for sure, no matter how intelligent you are, that in 50 years or 100 years, a given artwork is going to still have currency.
Back it out for me for a second and talk about the art market. How's the art market these days?
Well, like the rest of, I think, you could tell me better.
the art market.
Well, what I was going to say is that I think in some respects, like at least certain segments of the overall economy, there's climbing values and yet not as much clarity or consensus about why that's happening.
That's exactly what Jay Powell said the other day in his press conference after the Fed meeting. Oh, I said prices are elevated.
Gee.
There's lots of uncertainty out there.
Well, that's
really
yeah.
interesting.
I see at least the part of the art market that makes headlines. And I do want to say it's easy to get caught up in that part of the art market,
for sure.
But there are many art markets,
yeah.
right? And there are many emerging artists and galleries that aren't trafficking in works that are worth, you know, $1, $2, $3, $5 million
right.
dollars. And a lot of ways collectors, young collectors can get in and not have to participate in that part of the market.
Do you feel recessions when they happen? Does the art market feel a recession?
I have a minority view that 2008 was definitely a big deal for the art market, but it really was only a speed bump for the top end of the art market. And again, I think that might have some resonance.
It's exactly the same way in the rest of the economy.
Right.
Right?
That's
end had a speed bump and the rest of it was devastated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, interesting. The mantra in the economy, right, for companies and for institutions is grow or die, right? You got to get bigger. You got to keep growing. Do you have to do that as a museum? Do you have to do that as an art collector?
I think it's kind of human to want to keep growing and keep expanding. But I also think that museums are very particular organizational creatures, right?
Yeah.
So they are nonprofits, so you're basically generally on a fixed income, no matter how large your resources are. And in terms of growing, the way that we do want to grow, of course, is audience.
Yeah.
And in that sense, I am a bit of an evangelist, an art evangelist.
But 900,000 people a year come through here now. If you do really well and get 1.2 million or 1.5 million, the lines out front that you see driving down Grand Avenue are going to be even longer.
Yeah.
You all right with that?
Well, the lines aren't always
That's
super
true.
Long.
That is true.
There are, and I thought that we would have maybe already hit the ceiling before we got to 917,000 like we did last year. I think we can go a bit further. And I think another way we can expand our audience is by going out into the community.
Yeah.
Because no matter how high our attendance numbers get, I'm very, very cognizant of the fact that there are still millions of people in Southern California who maybe, hard to believe, might not know who we are yet.
Yeah, that makes sense. Joanne, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
There's a lot more to that tour and the conversation I had with Joanne Heiler, including what it's like to scout art from living artists. You can hear that on our Corner Office podcast. Also, a lot of art is visual, right? So we have put a video up of that tour we took on our YouTube channel. We are Marketplace APM there. This final note on the way out today, a quick Academy Awards followed. Taika Waititi won the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay. You might have seen that. And in his post-show press conference, He was asked what he would like the Writers Guild to ask for in its next round of negotiations with producers here, and this is actually true. This is what he said.
Apple needs to fix those keyboards. Though they are impossible to write on, they've gotten worse. It makes me want to go back to PCs, because PC keyboard, the bounce back on for your fingers is way better. And the hands up who still uses a PC.
I mean, my hand's up. Man's got a point, right? And there you go, quitting time. Dow Industrial is up 174 points today, 0.6%. The NASDAQ up 107 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 up 24 points, 0.7% there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.